My name is Jackie Summel. I'm an artist and activist who was invited to do an exhibition here in Quebec City.
And do you want to just describe the space we're in right now?
Sure. This exhibition is called The House That Herman Built, and it's based on someone who spent 42 years in solitary confinement in the United States, his vision of a dream home. So it's translated into various moments in history, like an architectural model. There's a CAD video, computer-aided drawing. There's some computer-aided photographs of his dream home, and then some translations of his drawings. And then we reconstructed the cell where he spent a majority of his 42 years of solitary confinement. So he spent 27 years in a cell this size.
And so we face that right here. So when people enter the gallery, they can enter into the replica of his cell themselves. Why was that important for you to have that representation, that physical representation of that space?
I mean, I think of the situation of Herman Wallace, Albert Woodfox, Robert King, and the 80,000 or more other prisoners who are kept in solitary confinement in the United States at any given moment as a confrontation. And it's a confrontation of reality that a lot of folks in North America are not really willing to accept. In the United States, we're supposed to have provisions against cruel and unusual punishment, and I have no doubt, and neither does the UN, that solitary confinement for more than 15 days is cruel and unusual punishment. And so it's important for me as an artist and as someone who interrupts some of the ideas of the status quo to really confront people with the reality of solitary confinement before they're gifted with various means of escaping solitary or transgressing or transcending the experience of solitary confinement. In this case, it's through dreaming of a home. Yeah.
And how did that idea of Herman Wallace's dream home begin? How did you first meet him?
I met Herman Wallace in 2001 after a man named Robert King was released. He had served 29 years of solitary confinement, 31 years of a wrongful conviction, and the state of Louisiana released him, and they were like, sorry, you know, good luck with your life. Here's your $11. And he managed to make his way to California, where I was studying, and he did a very small lecture. In fact, I believe King was on a television show recently. There's a documentary film about him.
Tout le monde en parle, which is one of the most watched television shows in Quebec.
Yeah, it's amazing, you know, that he's internationally celebrated. With the exception of the United States, he's not as highly embraced in the United States, which is true for this exhibition. And I think because if you open the history of the Angola Three, Herman Wallace, Albert Woodfox, and Robert King, you really expose historic and contemporary racism, which is something that Americans in general are not ready to accept or face or repair, you know. And so when I met King, I met somebody who was eloquent, who was calm, who was not angry, and I thought, I have something to learn from this man. And so I asked him how I could be involved in the lives of Herman and Albert, and he said, just write them, write my comrades. So that was the beginning of the journey.
And what was your first letter to Herman like? Do you remember?
Oh yeah, my first letter to Herman and Albert were identical, and I had no idea what to say, and I opened with that. You know, here's my life, and I have no way of imagining what yours is like. And what I did is I taped a disposable camera to my wrist and took a photograph, one photograph every hour on the hour, set an alarm so it would wake me up if I was asleep, etc. And I would just know to take a picture. And both Herman and Albert were amazed because it was photographs that anyone on the outside would normally just throw away, right? Pictures of like my socks or my blanket or the dashboard of my car, but they were pictures of things that they hadn't seen in, at that point, 30 years. Yeah. So that was the beginning. That was the beginning. And they were both so generous in their response and so delighted with those images. And from there, we embarked on this very casual exchange that then developed and grew into a friendship and collaboration and now my life's work. Yeah.
Had you ever written a letter to someone in prison before?
No, that's the first time I ever even thought about writing someone in prison. You know, we have a really good sort of media campaign in the United States where we convince the general public that those that are incarcerated are other, and, you know, we create this tension between us and them. And so it was never anything that crossed my mind at that point. I was 30 years old, you know, and then as I began to write them and then other prisoners reached out to me, I began to realize that, you know, behind the prison walls, inside the penitentiary, this idea of other is really identical, and the idea of prisoner is actually person, and that transformative shift was essential to my position in life today and who I am and my belief system and why I keep doing this. Yeah.
And you say keep doing this because this isn't the first time you've presented this work. It's the first time in Quebec City. But how many times have you presented Herman's house, or the house that Herman built?
So I've been working on this project since 2003, so it's about a decade. I've exhibited in over 11 countries, and I'm probably into the 20-somethings in terms of exhibitions. I don't really keep track, and there's always different ways of presenting. I don't always show the cell, for instance. I can't always transfer the model. So it's always, I've had the luxury of this being really flexible in terms of what we exhibit, and we still have the same sentiment of resistance and celebration of the imagination, despite everything that Herman Wallace had stacked against him. Yeah.
Add some flowers to the room. There's a king-size bed, crystal furniture, African art, mahogany furniture, lots of large murals, mirror ceilings, and a three-sided gas fireplace, and soft blue light. It is important to note, with respect to anyone who may be justly sensitive to animal rights, that the basket on the bed is indeed fake fur and is only there for decoration. There is a door leading from the master bedroom to the master bathroom with a 6-foot by 9-foot hot tub. The cell I presently live in is but 6 foot by 8 foot.
I'm struck by how compelling it is visually, how each image I've seen tells a story. You have the letters laid out in this space. You have this video playing where we hear the voice of Robert King. How have people reacted to you bringing this subject to the fore in this way?
I mean, one of the things that's really nice for me as an artist and activist is to see the conversation around solitary confinement shift in the last 10 years. So 10 years ago, I would have to explain so much more. What is solitary confinement? How does this happen? What are the patriarchal power structures of the prison industrial complex? And I don't have to do that as much. I don't have to deconstruct the system that allows this to happen. And so I have a little bit more opportunity to talk about resistance and imagination and the power of those that are forced to endure the impossible. And that gives people a sense of hope. And so it's really my intention, and I hope that people leave here not feeling disempowered or sad, but like they also can do something and they also can contribute to a more compassionate and beautiful world. And I will say it's the only exhibition I've ever been to where I've seen people cry. And I think that that collective catharsis is really important to structurally and socially healing and then structurally and socially changing. Yeah.
I'm interested if there are any links between the current shift of Canada's incarceration system modeling itself slightly after the American model. Have you talked to people about that?
I actually just lectured at Avatar, and you know, I said if we can export the popularity of pop stars and Disneyland, we can export our prison industrial complex. If we share in a global economy, then these are things that others will see as ways to profit. And it's my understanding that there's been shifts in terms of the amount of beds that are being built in prisons, and I have absolutely no doubt that you don't build prisons with more capacity unless you intend to fill it. And I mean, let there be no mistake that the prison industrial complex is a for-profit system. And, you know, a lot of people refer to it as the ghost of slavery, but I don't really think of it as a ghost. I actually think of it as the exact manifestation, another manifestation, an ancestor. Slavery was the ancestor to the prison industrial complex. So there's, nothing has died yet, you know. And I think identifying, accepting, and accepting that as reality allows you to change it fundamentally, which is what's necessary. And and I hope that, you know, this exhibition not only brings to the table conversations around the use of prolonged solitary confinement, but prison abolition, which is a really important conversation. Yeah, and if Canada is shifting towards more prison beds, that it invokes a sense of power to prevent that from happening. Yeah.
There was another moment you touched on. You were talking about exporting American pop culture, and one conversation that I've been seeing happening a lot more these days is around Orange is the New Black. I was wondering if people have talked to you about how solitary confinement is presented in that TV show, which is kind of presented as a comedy.
Right. I'm not critical of that either. I mean, I think that people are, it's like a spoonful of sugar, and people are not really willing to accept conversations around around punishment and the culture of punishment in which they may be implicit, right, or complicit, whether or not they're actively participating or by not contesting, they are complicit. They're allowing this to happen, and they're not willing to accept their own agency in systems of punishment. And I think the way to introduce that as a possibility is with a little buffer of humor. That's one way, right? And so I think that show is really strong. I think, and I could be wrong, but I believe that the next season, they had to test it out, and they can't talk about every single pernicious issue in terms of systems of punishment. And women, the conversation around women and incarceration is almost always ignored. And so I fundamentally think that her show is contributing to a conscientious shift in penitentiary, prison, and punishment policies. It's a lot of peas. I will also say one of the things I admire about Piper Kierman is that she didn't just leave it there. She didn't just leave it with the success of her book or the success of the show. She goes and speaks to Congress, for instance. She goes on the lecture tour.
Ranking Member Cruz and distinguished members of this committee, thank you for having me here to address this important issue. I spent 13 months as a prisoner in the federal system. If you are familiar with my book, Orange is the New Black, you know that I was never held in an isolation unit. The longest amount of time I was placed alone in a holding cell was 4 hours, and I was ready to climb the walls of that small room by the end of that. I am here today to talk specifically about the impact of solitary confinement on women in American prisons, jails, and detention centers. Women are the fastest growing segment of the criminal justice system.
She continues to push the issue, and I am really proud of her for that.
Have you met her?
I have met her, yeah, one time.
Has she seen this project?
She's never seen the exhibition. She's seen the documentary film, and she has a copy of my book.
Yeah. That's really interesting that there are those links there with someone who's a little bit more in the pop culture realm right now, there's only one season yet. The second season is coming. They released like a 15-second teaser or something the other week.
But I think Orange is the New Black is really exciting in terms of, you know, queering the lines of identity as well. And so not even talking, you know, about not leaving the prison industrial complex or this idea of being in prison to us and them, blurring those lines. And the white patriarchal powers and white feminine powers that are in control can suddenly see themselves in those characters. And then I think what's happening with Laverne Cox is really exciting, and she's fantastic and such an articulate speaker as well.
And collaborating with Cece MacDonald.
Absolutely.
As well,
like, yeah.
Starting that conversation about what it means to be an incarcerated trans woman in America today.
Right, and how do we identify trans people in terms of the culture of punishment? And this is really exciting. So I do think in general it's courageous work, and I consider it in parallel, you know, with the work I've been doing for the last 10 years. I'm very welcoming, yeah, super excited.
What was your reaction the first time you heard about Piper Kerman's work?
I don't have a television, and I very rarely watch movies, and, you know, I'm sort of removed from that unless it's through dinner conversation. And I got a really bad virus and was in bed for a few days, and that was the excuse to watch the first couple of episodes, and I couldn't stop. I was really engaged. The first one I was like, wait a second, you know, and then I gave it a second chance, watched the next one, and then was like, this is awesome. This is really powerful stuff. Yeah, it was great.
I have a similar relationship to television, to be perfectly frank. And also, like, I was having moments more of, like, the representation of a queer or bisexual woman was, there are moments where it's enraging, and there are other times where it's like, it's the only time that I've seen that kind of representation in American pop culture.
Right.
There's this all about.
It's, I mean, I think progress is slow. And just the fact that we're suddenly using the word queer in a way that's not negative is really exciting, and I think it's interrupting the status quo in a way that is important. You know, just creating a vibration or a ripple or however you want to think of it that ultimately will change things. And I mean, I say this a lot. Like, people talk about, like, mass incarceration, over-sentencing, solitary confinement, all of these things. And I'm like, it's the worst thing ever. And the truth is, it's not. There was far worse. Like, we were quartering people and pulling them apart with horses. There was public shaming. There was this horrible thing called the guillotine, et cetera, et cetera. And prisons were a conscientious solution to try and end that kind of egregious public punishment, public display of punishment. And so the momentum is towards compassion. We just keep kind of screwing up. And I don't want to lighten how horrible it is, but I think generally we are pushing the envelope towards an inclusive, compassionate society, and it's just really slow. And that includes the greater conversation and the intersection of the prison industrial complex, the military industrial complex, museum industrial complex, conversations around LGBTQ communities, et cetera, et cetera. All of them, I think, are moving forward towards compassion, and it's a really exciting time to be alive.
I like how you use the term we as a way of engaging. Like, we've messed up. You know, we haven't gotten to an ideal point yet because it's a collective work. We have to all think of how we're engaging in the way the prison system works, the justice system works.
Yeah,
so it's an interesting way of.
We just in the lecture, you know, one of the things they asked about was like, what do you do as an artist? Like, what is your, are you an artist or are you an activist? What is your practice? And I was like, for me, it's really ugly to just assume your own identity in terms of your work, your ideas, your practice, your this. This is all collective, whether or not we want to say, like, I hand built the cell or whatever. I didn't do this. This exists because of an entire history that is egregious and embarrassing and horrible. And because of my relationship with Herman Wallace, which has a whole other trajectory. And there is no I in the end, right? This is an absolute we. And I you know, the ego is very deceptive and also not very sexy. And so for me, it's natural to also queer those lines in terms of personal identity and accept and celebrate the us in everything, you know, and these moments of sharing to be moments of sharing and cooperation as, like, the most exciting moments of our lives.
The greenhouse strengthens the house with its added flow of created oxygen. It gives the house life and keeps it lumber from warping over a period of time. To the back of the master bedroom is a fireplace. On one of the three angle sides is a trap door that leads down to an escape route from this room through the chimney to an underground bunk. The underground bunk is 35 feet from the house. The bunk is really beneath the floor of the swimming pool.
The bunk is made of. Let's talk a little bit more about the visual aspect since we've gotten into the kind of nitty gritty about it. Do you want to start over by the letters?
Sure.
So I had the chance to look at them earlier, but Do you want to tell us how you decided what selection of letters to showcase here?
So this is the first time I've ever shown the letters, and I've been a little bit nervous to do it in the past because I don't want to objectify Herman in any way, shape, or form. You know, Herman is, in all intents and purposes, the man who raised me, and there's a very humanizing experience in bringing his voice to the public, and my fear was that in showing letters from Herman, I would reduce that to an object. And so the way I sort of countered that was to share letters that I sent him and that he sent me. And my hope is that these letters illustrate a really complex exchange and the amount of time that we spent engaging each other, everything from doodling on the outside of the envelope to the moments where he like draws a smiley face or remembers to ask me about my brother or shares his space through drawing and then I share my space through photograph, etc. So there's literally thousands of letters to choose from. And the ones that I chose were the ones that focused more on the house itself, but then also described like how much I was traveling around the world as an artist and how he remained my point of contact for 10 years. You know, he remained my steady for 10 years. Yeah.
And you were talking about the doodles, and there's one here with a cage and the address is written inside it and the cage is open. What were you thinking when you were deciding to doodle on the envelopes in this way?
I mean, I didn't think, you know, it's really... when you have the opportunity to let go of yourself and stop thinking about yourself, I think you're happiest. And there's a lot of that when in our relationship, and that's really liberating. You know, I mean, I think people can relate to it when you read a really good book, you stop thinking about yourself, you're just in the book, or you're, you know, watching a really good movie, or like I think a great example is like when children are on the playground and they're going down the slide, they don't do it so they could be like, I slid, right? They're like, I'm sliding. And those are the moments of exasperation and wonder and brilliance that I think we all strive for. And so when you work with an incarcerated population, there's a lot less time to reflect on yourself. And there's these really beautiful moments because they are relative to their situation, to being incarcerated in your life. So the things that seemed impossible 10 minutes earlier are suddenly privilege. And that's really transformative. And so there's a lot of letting go. And the doodles, I mean, I doodle. And so it's just this, like, I'm thinking about you, Herman, and I'm doodling. Yeah.
Were you making conscious choices with the stamps as well?
I liked, no.
There were like, there's the cute cats and dogs here, and there's Frida Kahlo over here.
This is him to me. So,
oh, yeah.
No, not necessarily. Although later in our relationship, there was some more recent Black History Month stamps that I was really excited to share with him. Yeah.
And there's some little echoes of Black History Month in this part of the exhibition as well, where he talks about what art he would want on the walls. Do you want to tell us about that?
Sure. So he had asked that he has a wall of revolutionary fame, where he chose 3 to 5 frames of abolitionists. And then he asked me to choose the rest, but I insisted that he be in charge. So he had chose Nat Turner, John Brown, Harriet Tubman, Gabrielle Prosser, and Denmark Vesey. And then later when Damon Eda Roddick, who was a staunch supporter of the Angola 3, passed, he asked that she be added to the wall as well.
Okay, and we see that representation that you've done using like architectural...
Right, computer-aided drawings.
So we see Harriet Tubman over here.
Yeah.
Just sitting next to the television and the bookshelves in his dream home.
Yeah, his wall of revolutionary fame. So it's Harriet Tubman. It's backwards in the order that I just read. John Brown and Denmark Vesey in the corner. Yeah.
And what is it like for you to step back in another gallery space and look at this house that you dreamed up with, or that Herman dreamed up with you?
I mean, this is the first time I've exhibited since Herman died. And so in a lot of ways, the responsibility of legacy is different. And my relationship to installing it. So I don't In the past, you know, I would be so excited to send him pictures of the gallery or whatever and then continue the conversation. And in this way, it feels a little more like a punctuation. And my greatest concern is that I'm honoring him appropriately.
And so what do you hope that people take away from this gallery space when they come in a way that would honor Herman?
I mean, I don't think that's any different than initially what I said, that I want people to leave here feeling hopeful and empowered and angry. And that they leave here with sort of the backdrop of reality, this overuse of solitary confinement, of mass incarceration, over-sentencing, etc. And then they use it as a way to diagnose what systems are being placed in Canada itself, and then prevent, because it's a lot easier to prevent than it is to change, for sure.
Thank you for telling me about Herman's house, which we can check out here in Quebec City.
Well, thanks so much for taking the time to go through the gallery, to interview me, and to get the word out. I really appreciate it. All power to the people.